Each week, American History TV sits in on a lecture with one of the nation's college professors. You can watch the classes here every Saturday at 8 p.m. and midnight Eastern, and Sundays at 1 p.m. This week, David Keene, president of the National Rifle Association, talks about the modern conservative political philosophy of William F. Buckley, Jr. Mr. Buckley, who died in 2008, was the founder of the National Review magazine. David Keene was a guest lecturer at the Citadel Military College in Charleston, South Carolina, in a course called The Conservative Intellectual Tradition in America, taught by Professor Mallory Factor. This is just over an hour and a half.
Thank you very much. Let me begin by thanking Mallory, and indeed the Citadel, for this opportunity to talk to you about my old friend and mentor, Bill Buckley. You should know that the opportunity to attend a course like this is almost unique in American higher education. I'd like to just begin by reading a reference to this sort of thing from the Chronicle Review, the Chronicle of Higher Education, written not too many years ago by a Columbia professor. He says, "The unfortunate fact is that American academics have until very recently shown little curiosity about conservative ideas, even though those ideas have utterly transformed American and British politics over the last 30 years. A look at the online catalogs of our major universities confirms this. Plenty of courses on identity politics, post-colonialism, nary a one on conservative political thought. Professors are expected to understand the subtle differences among gay, lesbian, and transgender studies, but I would wager that few can distinguish between the American Enterprise Institute, the Heritage Foundation, and the Cato Institute, three think tanks that have had greater impact on Washington politics than the entire Ivy League." So in many ways, I'm privileged and I'm honored to have an opportunity to be a part of a course like this at an institution like this. Like most conservatives of my generation, I was inspired by William F. Buckley. I began reading National Review as a high school student and can honestly say that to this day, the base of my political thinking derives from two giants, Bill Buckley and Friedrich Hayek, both of whom will figure in my remarks. Though I am today president of the National Rifle Association, I served for many years as chairman of the American Conservative Union, was a follower, a friend, and an ally of Bill Buckley, and I'm here today for that reason. As I was accepting this invitation, I was reminded of what Bill's brother Jim told me he asked of his colleagues in seeking permission to attend the 40th anniversary banquet of the New York Conservative Party some years ago. Jim, as Mallory pointed out, served a term in the United States Senate as that party's nominee. And when I left the Nixon White House, he asked me to be his executive assistant. Jim eventually got a steady job as a highly respected federal appeals court judge. Judges, you know, aren't supposed to participate in partisan activities, and he had to seek his colleagues' permission to attend the celebration. He told me I prevailed because I told them I wasn't being asked as an activist, but as an artifact of their successes in an earlier day. I resemble that remark. I'm here today as an artifact, or more properly perhaps as a witness to the development of a movement of which Jim and I were both a part, and to the role his brother played in calling that movement into being. Before I retreat into history, though, I'd like to make a pre-announcement announcement. As many of you may know, the NRA, through the NRA Foundation, provides grants to support the shooting sports. Many of these grants are requested by college shooting teams through the Friends of the NRA State Fund. The Citadel Pistol Team has requested such a grant to, as the grant application makes clear, introduce promising and motivated cadet student athletes to competitive pistol shooting and allow them to represent their school on a national level. That grant application has been approved, so congratulations. But let's get back to history. The early conservative movement was made up primarily of former Democrats or the sons and daughters of former Democrats, liberals, and even former socialists and communists. Frank Meyer, who Mallory Factor referred to a few minutes ago, and who was my mentor, was, I believe, the highest ranking domestic communist ever to defect from and to leave the Communist Party. He was not atypical. Like many who joined up early, I too began as a Democrat. At 15, I stood in the snows of Wisconsin during the 1960 Democratic primary, passing out literature for John F. Kennedy. That was where you might have expected me, as I came from a working class labor family. My father was not just a working man, but a union activist. He spent years as a labor union organizer and 10 years as the president of the Rockford, Illinois Labor Council. My mother was elected as the president of the Women's International Auxiliary of the United Auto Workers. And when I stood in the snow that year, they had never voted for a Republican for anything. All of that changed for me and for many of my generation because of Bill Buckley and the ideas he popularized. His influence is acknowledged by all involved in or witness to the development of the modern conservative movement. George Nash, author of the most thorough history of the development of the post-World War II conservative intellectual movement in this country, has said of Buckley, and I'm quoting, "He was arguably the most important public intellectual in the United States in the past half century. For an entire generation, he was the preeminent voice of conservatism." Indeed, he was. My own conversion, if you will, came about while I was still in high school, about a year into the Kennedy administration. I was interested in politics, and more importantly, in ideas. Our high school librarian, perhaps a closet conservative herself, called me over to her desk one day and told me that she had ordered a copy of a book by an economist by the name of Friedrich Hayek, which she had now been told could not be put on the school library shelf. To the liberals of the 50s and 60s, Hayek was a dangerous radical, and for good reason. His road to serfdom was already beginning to undermine the liberal consensus. The book that had been banned from our school, though, was not The Road to Serfdom, but a book titled The Constitution of Liberty. Our high school librarian wasn't about to throw it out, so she told me I could have it if I wanted it. I did. I took it home. I read it. I still have it. As preparation for this lecture, I believe you've all read Hayek's Why I Am Not a Conservative, which was a chapter in that book, The Constitution of Liberty. Hayek, of course, was a libertarian free market economist. The modern conservative movement had not really come into being at the time he wrote that book. From Hayek to Buckley was an easy and a natural step. Like thousands of young conservatives, I devoured each issue of National Review and can attest to the accuracy of Nash's assessment of Buckley's importance. China's Mao Zedong once famously observed that political power grows from the barrel of a gun. But history tells us something different entirely. Political power and influence comes ultimately from the power of ideas. Back in 1936, the economist John Kenneth Galbraith, who in spite of his misunderstanding of economics was a lifelong friend of Bill Buckley's, wrote that, quote, "ideas are more powerful than is commonly understood. Indeed, the world is ruled by little else. Madmen in authority who hear voices in the air are distilling their frenzy from some academic scribblers of a few years back. Sooner or later, it is ideas, not vested interests, which are dangerous for good or for evil," unquote. Galbraith, of course, at the time was referring to the scribblings of Marx and the nativist German philosophers who together were to produce the monsters of the 20th century, Lenin, Stalin, Hitler, and Mao himself. But Galbraith, too, was a scribbler whose ideas came to dominate the economic thinking of politicians the world over for decades, but were ultimately discredited and deposed by other ideas that were beginning to take root as his influence peaked. William F. Buckley was all about ideas. In today's world, he would be described, not inaccurately, as a public intellectual, for he gave voice to the ideas that were to culminate in the modern conservative movement that he, more than anyone, called into being. He burst on the scene at the age of 26 with God and Man at Yale, a critique of the educational homogenization to which he was subjected as an undergraduate. And within a couple of years, he founded National Review, a journal of opinion that would change the world. He edited National Review for nearly four decades, churned out an estimated 350,000 published words a year while traveling the country to give speeches and debate liberals of his day on more than 500 American campuses. Buckley came to Madison, to the University of Wisconsin, where I was an undergraduate for one of those speeches in the early 60s, and it was there that we first met. Think about the output of this man. During those same years, he published more than 50 books. He hosted nearly 1,500 episodes of Firing Line on public television. He was instrumental in the founding of the Intercollegiate Society of Individualists, now the Intercollegiate Studies Institute, the Young Americans for Freedom, which the Washington Post's David Broder later said was the most influential youth organization of its era, and the Philadelphia Society. He brought the disparate wings of an emerging new conservatism together to create a politically viable movement where none had existed. As a result of his efforts, Barry Goldwater won the Republican Party presidential nomination in 1964, transformed the GOP, and set the stage for the Reagan challenge to an incumbent president four years later that made possible Ronald Reagan's election in 1980. To grasp the enormity of this accomplishment, one has to remember just what the political and intellectual landscape looked like in the years following the Second World War. In his monumental book, Commanding Heights, Harvard's Daniel Yergin describes the late 40s, 50s, and early 60s as a period in which a collectivist faith in government dominated the world. Britain had gone socialist and was busy nationalizing its industry. Sweden had already done it. Country after country was developing 5- and 10-year plans under which the state would direct the economy. History seemed not just to be on the side of collectivism and socialism, but of communism. One has to remember or realize that when Whitaker Chambers abandoned the communists and penned Witness, he was convinced that he was leaving the winning for the losing side. In this country, establishment intellectuals like Lionel Trilling dismissed the very idea of an American conservative tradition as silly at best and pathological at worst. And even today, some psychologists view conservatism in much the same light. This was the 1955 world that young Bill Buckley set out to challenge and perhaps to change. The words of Buckley's mission statement that appeared in his new magazine's maiden issue in November of 1955 said it all. National Review, he wrote, stands athwart history, yelling stop at a time when no one is inclined to do so or to have much patience with those who so urge it. Buckley didn't know if he or we would prevail, but he knew what he had to do. And that, of course, was to try. He added, there never was an age of conformity quite like this one. And he was dead right. But as Yergin points out in his History of the Time, under the surface, things were beginning to change. And Bill Buckley was to be the catalyst for popularizing and shaping that change both intellectually and politically. Yergin suggests that the most important publishing decision of the era was made by the Reader's Digest, which some years earlier had decided to publish and thus make both famous and influential a book by that Austrian economist, Friedrich Hayek, who was then in residence at the University of Chicago. It was his Road to Serfdom, and it influenced the thinking of millions around the world, including a young Hollywood liberal by the name of Ronald Reagan and a British undergraduate who carried a copy of the book around in her purse and grew up to become the longest-serving prime minister in British history. The movement back in those days was tiny, but it was growing. Like most young intellectually-based movements, it consisted mainly of academics, students, and writers who spent an inordinate amount of time and energy arguing about minor as well as major doctrinal differences. There were the objectivist followers of the newly famous Ayn Rand, the remnants of the old anti-Roosevelt coalition, a scattering of isolationists and racists, states' rightists, and even a monarchist or two. There were religious extremists and conspiracy theorists. When my father's union organizing days were over, he bought a bar. As he prepared to open that bar, he gave me what turned out to be pretty good political advice that I've never forgotten. He said that when you open a bar, you have to spend the first month or so throwing out all of those who've already been thrown out of every other bar in town, because if you don't do that, he said, no one else is ever going to come in to your establishment. Conservatives in the late 50s were facing a similar problem as they tried to put together and open a movement with an appeal that wouldn't be limited to malcontents and ideologues who couldn't find a home anywhere else and who could, if they were let in, keep everyone else out. Buckley and his band of merry men and women at National Review decided that their immediate mission was to get rid of the crazies, the racists, and those who couldn't get along with others, while molding the rest into a coalition that might actually both present an intellectually defensible conservatism and hope eventually to influence the nation's culture and politics. Through National Review, Buckley began knitting together supporters of different strains of quasi-conservative thought that he and his followers believed legitimate and capable of working in a coalition to form a viable conservative political movement. Every few years, a reporter or an analyst discovers that the conservative movement is far from monolithic, but more closely resembles a coalition of interests that differ in almost as many respects as not. When that happens, articles appear wondering if this movement can survive these different views and these strains, as if a successful political movement must be both monolithic and homogeneous to be either effective or to survive. Communists and most totalitarian ideological movements have always tried to suppress dissent and differences within their ranks, fearing, like the religious leaders of a different era in the West and of today in the Middle East, that dissent must ultimately lead to factionalism and failure. In the 1960s, three main conservative camps had sometimes conflicting but overlapping views. They were the anti-communists, who, like Buckley, Chambers, Meyer, Burnham, and the rest, saw Marxism-Leninism as an existential threat to everything they held dear. Libertarianism, a belief in limited government, free markets, and individual liberty. And what we then called traditionalism, the belief that free men must act morally to preserve those rights that they loved. Buckley and Frank Meyer believed that these three basic camps faced the very same threats. Free markets, individual autonomy, and religious freedom were all threatened by communism. The United States was a fortress of freedom in a dangerous world. Anyone who valued tradition or freedom was in the very same boat, and none could afford to push the other overboard lest they all perish. The result was what Frank Meyer termed fusionism. Meyer rejected a valueless libertarianism as well as state-directed virtue. The result was a belief in what he called libertarian means to a traditionalist end, a good society built by men and women freely choosing to pursue moral goals and ends. This, combined with hostility toward totalitarianism, gave him what is now referred to as the three-legged stool that makes up the conservative movement. But first, they had to throw the folks out who were keeping the others from entering. Each camp had hangers-on who could endanger the whole enterprise and therefore had to go. The first to go were the Birchers. The John Birch Society was the brainchild of a Belmont, Massachusetts businessman by the name of Robert Welch, and was named for a soldier killed in Korea shortly after World War II ended by a communist Chinese soldier. Welch considered him the first casualty of the Cold War, as he may well have been. The society attracted tens of thousands of followers around the country, but it quickly became apparent that Welch was a conspiracy theorist of the first order. And because there weren't very many organizations on the right, the more liberal media leaped on the John Birch Society as a way to tar the emerging conservative movement as a bunch of folks much like the John Birch Society's founders. Today one finds folks like him among the truthers and the birthers. But in those days, his bizarre theories were easily caricatured by a hostile establishment and used to tar conservatives like Buckley himself as part of what the press liked to refer to as the lunatic fringe. Buckley famously read the Birchers out of the movement, and those of us in his camp followed suit. At the time, I was a board member of the Young Americans for Freedom, which I later chaired. We passed a resolution denouncing the Birchers at our national convention. They walked out. It wasn't easy at the time, but it was politically necessary, and we all had a sense that it was the right thing to do. Welch had famously, or perhaps I should say infamously, suggested that President Dwight Eisenhower was a conscious agent of the communist conspiracy. Russell Kirk, another conservative and ally of Buckley's, responded, "Ike isn't a communist, he's a golfer." Next to go were the Objectivists, who Buckley saw as too doctrinaire and whose militant atheism offended him and offended other conservatives. And finally, the racists and extreme libertarians, who at the time seemed more interested in selling the highways and legalizing drugs while agreeing with the so-called New Left that the U.S. rather than the communist world was mainly responsible for the Cold War, had to go. Remember, it wasn't just that Buckley found the beliefs of the Birchers, of the Objectivists, the racists, and the monarchists objectionable, though he did, but that he was trying desperately to put together a coalition that could present an appealing and consistent philosophical message to those fed up with the direction in which the United States seemed to be heading in the 50s. Buckley, of course, succeeded beyond his wildest dreams. By 1964, the new conservatives would nominate Barry Goldwater, drive the Eastern establishment packing, or so it seemed at the time, and effectively seize control of one of the nation's major political parties. Following the Goldwater defeat, a defeat which Buckley both predicted and told young conservatives in a private meeting before the election, told them that it would be a good thing for a couple of reasons. Most importantly, the reason being that he said if Goldwater were to have won, who would run the government? Because there were not conservatives at that time who had moved beyond theoretical thinking to actually applying their philosophy to real-world problems. I still remember the first book published in those days that took conservative philosophy and tried to address a concrete problem. It had begun as a PhD thesis by a young student at Stanford. It was named Marty Anderson, who later served in several administrations. It was called The Federal Bulldozer, an attack on the urban renewal program of the era. And I still have that book. It was important not because of its solutions, but because it was an initial attempt by somebody to say, it's time to stop just debating ideas in the coffee house and to go out and decide what we would do if we were in fact in a position to do anything. But following that defeat, Buckley urged conservatives, as I say, to begin putting together this infrastructure. The infrastructure needed to train men and women to not just run for office, but to govern. He was instrumental in the formation of the American Conservative Union in late 1964, And in 1965, he ran for mayor of New York. Not because he expected to win. He famously said that if he did win, he would demand a recount. But to demonstrate to his fellow conservatives that it was possible to mount a conservative political offensive against the liberal establishment in what most of us considered the belly of the liberal beast. Conservatives around the country listened, they followed that campaign, they cheered Bill Buckley on, they took heart, and they began filing for office themselves. They even began to win. The Republican Party had been declared dead by the establishment after the 1964 election, but it was open for business under new ownership. Ronald Reagan was elected governor of California in 1966 and considered running against Richard Nixon and Nelson Rockefeller 2 years later, but ultimately decided it was too early. The result, of course, was Nixon and Watergate, and then finally, Ronald Reagan, and the triumph of a movement that began as a gleam in the eye of young Bill Buckley. By 2007, Reagan was gone, but George W. Bush presented Bill Buckley the Medal of Freedom at a White House ceremony honoring his life, his work, and acknowledging the debt that the country and all of us owed him. By then, though, Buckley sensed that the movement he built was fraying around the edges. He was convinced that the balance that had existed among the various constituencies that made up the movement was somehow off kilter. It seemed to him that some, like the young president who placed the medal around his neck, just didn't get it. That others who had come to Washington to do good had stayed to do well. And that the sectarianism and hubris that they demonstrated was leading the movement down the road to potential disaster. Buckley had never been orthodox in his conservatism. He didn't believe that conservatism was ideological so much as a way of looking at life. He opposed any descent into a doctrinaire, ideological way of thinking. That was one of the reasons he had so much trouble with Ayn Rand and the Objectivists. Over the years, he differed with fellow conservatives on all manner of important issues. He favored the legalization of marijuana for both libertarian and empirical reasons. The war on drugs, he felt, would never be won and was too costly to continue. But he also favored national service, mostly for empirical reasons. He looked back on the way a generation had been socialized during the 40s and 50s through military service and thought young people in the nation had benefited greatly from that socialization. Buckley supported the initial invasion of Iraq on national interest grounds, but was quickly repelled by the very idea that it might be possible, let alone advisable, to try to remake that nation in our image. He made it clear that he thought we should get out. He'd never been a follower, and when he sensed that a new generation of conservatives was leading the movement off in directions he considered politically and philosophically unsound, he spoke up. His fusionism was threatening to come apart at the seams as a result of its own success. Frank Meyer, when warned by a young activist years ago that in power, the different constituencies that made up the movement might want very different things and be willing to use the power of the state in very different ways than he foresaw, Meyer suggested that we could fight battles over those things in the basement of the White House if and when we ever ended up there. At the time, of course, the idea that we would end up there was fairly far-fetched. But we did end up in the White House. And once we got there, the differences began to surface, in part because the various constituencies could surface them, and in part because many were not sufficiently socialized into the movement that Buckley had formed. In the early days, this hadn't been a problem. We argued the issues and we came to accommodationist solutions. We took all of these things into consideration and we got it. My own experience was perhaps typical, or at least not atypical. I was mentored by Frank Meyer himself, which was quite an experience. Meyer, as I said earlier, was the highest ranking American communist to defect, and in those days, the communists took that sort of thing seriously, and the Kremlin took out a contract on him. He took to hiding during the day and working at night, ensconced in a farmhouse in upstate New York. He would get up when the rest of humanity was going to bed, work all night, and then sleep all day, as he had learned to do while he was on the lam. But Frank was not just the book review editor of National Review. He was the conscience of this new movement. And unlike some who defected, he would not even for a minute accept the fear expressed by Whitaker Chambers that he had left the winning for the losing side. Frank had never been in a battle that he did not expect to win, and he expected to win this one. Frank meant to beat the communists, and as one who had been in charge of recruiting and training new party members, he knew how to go about looking for, finding, and motivating young conservatives. Every couple of months, he'd invite, or perhaps order me, to come to Woodstock, New York. I'd dutifully fly to New York, catch a bus to Woodstock, and arrive in the evening just as he was ready to start a quasi-Socratic educational session that would last far into the night. He'd want to know what I'd read since we'd last met, what I'd accomplished, and what I was going to accomplish when I got back to Wisconsin. Back in Madison, after getting some rest and sobering up, I'd get calls late in the evening from Frank Meyer, checking to make certainly I was doing what I had agreed to do and making progress in the struggle in which we were all involved. In between my assigned readings, I would attend workshops organized by the Intercollegiate Society of Individualists, or ISI. I would organize and debate, and if I was lucky, I might get to do a little studying. It was an exhilarating time for me and for those like me. We knew what the movement is about, but with political success, it began to grow perhaps too quickly. I've observed in a different context that one can tell that an idea-driven movement is on the verge of political success when the rats board the ship. The new recruits that streamed in added to our numbers and were well-intentioned, but there were too many to educate as thoroughly as Frank and his fellows had educated those of us who were with him in the beginning. And before long, they began to say they were conservatives not because of Hayek or Buckley or Kirk, but because they liked Reagan or Bush or Gingrich. If you took away Gingrich or Reagan or Bush and asked them then why they were conservatives, they couldn't answer that question. Our task today, and it is one in which many conservatives are engaged, is to re-socialize the core and remind new recruits of just what it means to be a conservative rather than just conservative. The distinction is all important. As witness Buckley's description of George W. Bush, quote, he is conservative, Buckley told an interviewer, but he is not a conservative. In other words, he didn't get it. In recent years, there have emerged or re-emerged folks that we call paleoconservatives, national defense conservatives, social and religious conservatives, constitutional conservatives, big government conservatives, and neoconservatives, all trying and fighting for the right to redefine and lead the movement Buckley called into being, reminding one of the time that Al Gore, campaigning in Milwaukee, mistranslated E Pluribus Union as out of one many. A few years ago, at the Conservative Political Action Conference that Mallory mentioned earlier, we honored Bill's brother Jim and former Minnesota Senator Eugene McCarthy for their 1974 challenge to that era's campaign finance reform. In responding to the toast, the liberal Gene McCarthy stood up and said, "You conservatives have had a good run, but you are in trouble. Because I keep hearing talk of hyphenated conservatives. That's what happened to liberals in the 60s. And when they start referring to you in hyphenated terms, you are headed for a crack up." As Bill looks down on us today, he is no doubt hoping that we will be far wiser than McCarthy's liberals, and that we will work as hard to preserve our coalition as he did to build it. Thank you very much.
We're going to take a short break and be right back with questions and answers. Welcome back. With me is David Keene, and we're now going to take questions from the cadets. Question. Mr. Salmaska.
Sir, you described the political and economic landscape post-World War II as a collectivist faith in government sort of dominating. But to me, I kind of see that not a lot has changed. We still look to the government for entitlement, student loans, natural disasters, and even today, healthcare and birth control. Has anything really changed?
In some ways it has. Depends on whether you look at the glasses half full or half empty. The Reagan years changed the way in which people looked at government programs. Prior to Reagan and post-Roosevelt, there was an assumption that if there was a problem, the solution was to spend money on it. And anybody who questioned that obviously didn't want to solve the problem. After Reagan, there was, and that of course was a rebuttable presumption. After Reagan, there was a presumption, and you still see it, that if you have a problem and you want to spend money on it, that's not the answer. That's rebuttable as well. So it changed the way people looked at these things. And that lasted for some time. Now, if you ask whether the government is bigger now than it was then or it was in the 50s, obviously it is. And what we have now is we have sort of politically two things have happened. One, the sort of bipartisan establishment thinking of the 50s and 60s, which was almost all in favor of government solutions to everything, has broken down. But now you have two relatively evenly divided camps. And it's one of the reasons why politics has become so, the critic would say, dysfunctional, bitter, divided. It's become that way because now we have two camps with very, very different views of the way this country should be run and the very, very different visions of what the future should be like. If the conservative movement hadn't risen from 1955 on, if Reagan had not been elected, you wouldn't believe how far down that road we might be today. Have we turned around and moved backward? We did for a few years. But that final decision in terms of in any great length of time has not been made. That has to be made by the voters. In many ways, this election may be less about all the personalities that are involved than it is about that question. Because if you think about where the two parties are, throwing out all of the personalities again, one of the parties, the Republicans, have said it's gone too far. We're on the road to bankruptcy. We can't do this. We can't tax and spend and do what we've done before because we're about to hit the wall the way Greece and other places have done it. The other party is making a bet that they've always made, and that is, you've said the sky's going to fall before, and it never has, and we're just going to go on. So that you notice in the State of the Union message, the president never mentioned the debt. He never mentioned the deficits. He just said we need to spend more money. In a historical sense, that's a better bet, because they've won that one a lot of times. The Republicans are making a more dangerous bet because their bet is based on the fact that the reality has changed and that the public recognizes that change and will therefore vote differently. But this could be the election that's decided on the debate between those two views rather than on which candidate smiles better, who has a better family, or who comes from your state, or those kinds of things. So your answer is no, that hasn't ended. And it was Reagan who famously said that at any and all times, the loss of freedom is but a generation away. Much of what Reagan did in the United States, or go to England, what Thatcher did in England, has almost been forgotten as those countries have moved in other directions since. So it's the kind of thing you have to do every day. And believe me, when I was a student, Democrats nationally outnumbered Republicans 2-1, liberals outnumbered conservatives in polls 3-1. And today, that's not the case. That's reversed. So there's been a vast change as a result of these ideas, but that has not all translated into public policy because, you know, coming from nowhere to 49% or 51% is a big deal, but it doesn't take you all the way.
Next question, Mr. Lacey.
Sir, I was wondering if you could expound on the idea you mentioned about re-socializing the core. Did you talk about the difference between having conservatives because of Reagan, Gingrich, or Bush versus, you know, Hayek and Kirk? I feel like it's not, like we're not learning about Hayek and Kirk in school, and I feel the media produces more Reagan, Gingrich, or Bush conservatives. So,
well, my reference isn't to whether you read Hayek or whether you read Kirk or someone else, but that the movement of ideas, which was really a movement of people who got it, who understood the ideas, who understood they were conservative because of a certain view of man and the future and the role of government, was replaced by people who liked Reagan. You know, and they sort of shared, Al Regnery, who spoke to you earlier, and wrote a book on the movement, began a book with a story that I had told him about shortly after George H.W. Bush was elected president. His brother called me and said that he was going to run against Lowell Weicker in the primary in Connecticut. Actually, the families had lived next door to each other and the kids didn't get along, which was the real reason. But he said, I need your help because we conservatives have to stick together. And I said, Prescott, you are not a conservative. You have never been a conservative, and you will never be one. If you want my help because I don't like Lowell Weicker, that's one thing, but don't try that one. And he said, no, you don't understand. Now that Reagan's been elected, we're all conservatives. And that's what I'm talking about. Because it was more a political thing than a philosophical thing. And a movement of ideas, this doesn't just take place among conservatives. Think of the communist world. By the time the Soviet Union collapsed, the Communist Party was like the Rotary Club, more dangerous than the Rotary Club. But you would have been hard pressed to find a communist in that party. They were there because they got jobs. They were there, you know. They were there because that was how you succeeded. It was a key to get into various places and the like. And in its worst description, it was a bunch of thugs, but it wasn't a bunch of Marxist-Leninists anymore. There was no faith there. Everybody, as the Soviet Empire collapsed, had their moment when they realized it was really over. My moment came, and it exemplifies this, if you'll remember in Romania, or if you read in Romania, Ceausescu ordered his troops to fire on his citizens. They did. And then the general who carried out the order committed suicide, because in order to perpetrate the inhumanity that the communists perpetrated, the people who did it had to believe in something. They had to, you know, they had to believe they weren't just killing people, they were doing it for a higher good. And when that general committed suicide, that told you they didn't have any religion anymore, and that he couldn't live with himself for having done it. Their ideas were gone and their movement collapsed. And that's on the communist side, I'm not drawing any kind of an analogy in the sense, but as Jürgen points out, successful political movements begin with ideas. They then become successful, and people rush in, and the ideas begin to get diluted and they become about other things. They become about power and jobs and success. When I was a young conservative, if you were graduating from the Citadel, you did not join up with us because it was the road to success. That was the road to oblivion. You know, so if you joined, you joined because you believed and you wanted to believe. By 1985, you joined because you might get a job in Washington, or you might get this, or you might get that. And that's a whole different thing. Now, you need those people to be successful. But as your numbers grow, you have to make sure that as many as possible are socialized into the beliefs that motivate it in the first place. And that's what I was really talking about. So what I've been preaching this for some time, is what conservatives now have to do is go back and recreate that core, recreate the people who get it. And then the rest of the folks are people that you welcome into your movement, but you don't rely on them for to steer the ship, because they don't really know where it's going.
Buckley's fusionism was a really movement of ideas.
That's
not
my point.
A political movement.
Right, correct.
Initially, I mean, you had National Review, Modern Age, ISI, YAF, the Freeman. But finally, it finds an expression in the New York Conservative Party and
Buckley
the
Goldwater
candidacy. When did that
Well, Buckley was, fusionism was in large measure an attempt to mold, to take the ideas and to create, to make them saleable, to make them into something that could one day become a movement. But in the early days, a movement of ideas begins with really debates on college campuses. You know, whether, no matter what movement it is, in coffee houses, if you will, or in bars. It begins with writers writing and talking and arguing. If you go back to communism, remember the period when they were in exile. That's what they did. They honed their philosophy and they came up with something they thought in their context they could sell, at least with the aid of some guns. And that was at the time. The importance of the Buckley run for mayor, for example, was that you could actually go out and run for office. You know, that was something that you could, this was the beginning of another stage. And there was a sense at that time that maybe you could do something. The two most important elections in many ways of that era before the Reagan victory in 1980 were the Goldwater campaign of 1964 in the Republican Party and the McGovern campaign in the Democratic Party. Both of those campaigns lost. And both of them brought a generation of people that disagreed very much, but idea-based people into their party, and both of them took over their parties. And the Goldwater campaign really told conservatives that they could win. Now, if you look at the history, Goldwater, who became the hero of the right even before the publication of Conscience of a Conservative, stood up on the Senate floor and was often the only vote on things, and accused the Eisenhower administration of running what he called was a dime store New Deal, and that had to stop. I mean, he was saying, we cannot be just a pale imitation of them. If we are, why are we in this business in the first place? And we aren't going to succeed anyway. Goldwater was nominated for, his name was put in nomination in Chicago in 1960 for the vice presidential nomination, and got up and gave a famous speech in which the most remembered lines are, conservatives grow up. You can take this party. Buckley and these people were putting this together, beginning to shift it into a political mode with the things that you talked about. And Barry Goldwater said, now's the time. Now's the time to stop arguing among yourselves in the coffee shop, to get out and organize and take over this party. And that's what happened after Chicago. They marched out and they took over that party and they nominated Goldwater in 1964. And that changed the world.
Do you see that happening today?
Well, we're not in that kind of stage. We're now in a sort of fight within the party it's very different. I mean, somebody's told me it was how great it was in those days. You know, It's sort of like in the military. Wasn't it wonderful when you had the Nazis, you know, you could fight, or the communists, instead of these people you can't find? And he said the same. He said, you know, back in those days it was Rockefeller and Percy, you know, and these people who came out and said, we're liberals. And then the conservatives said, there they are, let's get them. And now we have fights in which five candidates get up and say, I'm a conservative, and I'm more conservative than he is, you know. And so it's a different kind of world. So the question now is not who's a better conservative, because if you look at, and I'm looking at it now in a purely political standpoint, but if you look at that, the question is, who will do the things that need to be done? And how do you get them done? Not how do you put that together, because it is, in fact, together.
Question. Yes, Mr. Mellon.
Kind of going off that, this current primary has all three legs of the conservative stool. It has the big government conservative, it has a libertarian, it has social conservatism. To what extent is the eventual nominee going to set the tone for the future of the Republican Party?
The nominee always, to some extent, does. One of the things that a party does not have, the way our parties work, it's the guy that gets nominated for the presidency that really sets it up. Depending on who is nominated, obviously you'll have a different emphasis, but all of them have to put all of those different things together, and all of them will present a conservative message. And the interesting thing, there was a Washington Post article the other day and said the interesting thing is that these candidates really don't disagree on very much. You know, they don't like each other. You know, they'd all like to have the job, but their disagreement is not as significant as you might think it is, except with Ron Paul on some issues. But even there, most Republicans agree with Ron Paul on about 85% of the stuff. He falls into, I think, in the readings for this course, there was one of Russell Kirk's readings about the libertarians. Kirk overstates it because he dislikes them as much as they disliked him. But the libertarian, the problem of in all of these places of going to extremes, and of course a libertarian didn't go to extremes, Kirk says, wasn't really a libertarian, he was a conservative, but is that is on the foreign policy side. Although Paul's getting a lot of support there because the other candidates have all sort of adopted a neoconservative position on foreign policy, which is the U.S. role is to go forward and remake the world in its own image. Paul is way extreme the other way. But the libertarian sort of apostasy on that came about because their analysis of history, which is entirely correct, is that the growth of the superstate is a result of what they call the warfare state. That it's the need to get resources and command an economy to go to war that created everything from the income tax to the regulations and all these things. And back during the 70s, they then said, well, so if you didn't have to have a war, then you wouldn't grow the government. And that logically follows. But if there's an existential threat, then you have to spend all this money on defense. But what if there isn't? Well, then you wouldn't have to. So they ended up in the 70s with the new left saying the Cold War was really our fault, because if it was our fault, we could stop it. If it was the Soviets, we couldn't stop it. Then we had to defend. And I remember the recently deceased chairman of the Cato Institute, who was a dear friend of mine, Bill Niskanen, an economist. He just recently died. I remember after the Cold War ended and the libertarians were not involved in CPAC and things like this, I said, you should come back in, because now you're not a borderline traitor, you're just an interesting eccentric. But what they did was, when you have an ideology and you take it, you know, and you say, well, now how do I get to where I want to go? That's where Ron Paul does the same thing today. He says we shouldn't be invading all these countries. I agree with him on that. But then he says the reason we shouldn't do it is this is all our fault. And that's not true. But what you get in these camps, you see it with Kirk's hostility toward the libertarians. You see it with the objectivists, you know, attack on religion and all that. Is you get people that are ideologically motivated primarily to construct a world that doesn't exist, and that's the legitimacy of Kirk's observation was also the legitimacy of what Buckley was dealing with. And he was saying, okay, let's get real, guys. You know, it doesn't work quite this way, and you can't be that ideological. But that fight is an important fight, which is going on now, I would say, in the movement, but now, unlike the 60s, the movement is reflected by the Republican Party. And you've got the, just there are a couple of examples right now. There's a fight going on over the control of the Cato Institute between the Koch brothers, and Cato was originally the Koch Brothers Foundation, and then became Cato, and the current people who control the Cato Institute, because they are libertarians who are basically, who basically say a pox on both your parties. And the Kochs are saying, we're libertarians who think that that doesn't get you very far. You know, now, that's a legitimate argument within that movement. On the other side, you have people now who are beginning to say, we can't remake the world in our image. That was something that the neoconservatives really wanted to do. That we could make Iraq into little America. Afghanistan is a place where we could have elections. And I was in Vietnam right after. And I had this fight. I'm taking too long. I'm branching out from here, but I'm going to do it anyway because I'm long-winded. But I think it was 65, 66, maybe. Lyndon Johnson went to Hawaii and basically said, we are going to win the Vietnam War with village elections. I asked when we were in the middle of the Iraq War, I was at a meeting where they sent somebody from the National Security Council to explain how we were going to win the Iraq War. And I said, sounds like you've got a plan. You're going to keep applying it until you find someplace where it works. So we ordered then the Diem, it was the Diem government still. We ordered them to have village elections. So they went, and our greatest allies in Vietnam, and I raised this question in an argument with Frank Fukuyama, who was a leading neocon, our greatest allies were the Montagnard tribesmen, who were not even Vietnamese, they're Polynesians, nobody even knows why they're there, they're up in the mountains. And they were repelled by the regimentation of the communists as they came down, and they became our really strongest allies in the war. The Vietnamese army showed up at this village and told them they were going to have an election. And they all looked at them and said, we've been choosing our head man for 5,000 years, you know, in this whatever way Stone Age cultures do this. Mm-hmm. And they said, no, you have to have an election. So that night they told the American advisors to stay in their tents, and they beheaded all the South Vietnamese soldiers that had come up there. And I raised the point to Frank. I said, what right? These were our allies. These were people who fought with us. And they were fighting with us for all the reasons we wanted them to, because they wanted to be free of this. What right did we have to tell them they had to change their governmental selection process that had been in place for 5,000 years? And I said, that was absurd. He said, on the contrary, you don't understand. That was the most important thing we could have done, because we need to remake things this way. And the neoconservatives really believe that. That just leads to a lot of beheadings, you know. And fortunately, nobody told those tribesmen that the South Vietnamese had been ordered to do that by the Americans. So the Americans got to survive the evening. But that had never been the Republican position. Remember, George W. Bush ran for president as opposed to what they call nation building, which is part of what that's all about. And it was after 9/11 that he was sold on the idea that if you remember the line that you often hear, we have to do that because democracies don't make war on each other. And my response was, what about Pennsylvania and Virginia in 1861? You know, I mean, that has little to do with it in reality. So those are important fights that are taking place, but as Buckley would say, if he looked at that, those are fights on the margin, because the core of the Republican Party would fit in with this fusionist kind of view. I mean, if you asked Rick Santorum, he'd agree with Ron Paul on more things than he disagrees with him on.
You talked about how ideas require repudiation of false conservatism. And Buckley's ideas led to them throwing out John Birch, you mentioned that, the John Birch Society, and the Ayn Rand's objectivists. But today, a lot of the Bircheresque mm-hmm. Movement in terms of immigration and Ayn Rand has become mainstream. How did that occur?
Well, in part,
I won't say mainstream, but
there was an argument about ideas, which is one thing. But what Buckley was trying to do, remember, was construct a saleable package of conservative ideas.
That's changed
in a lot of ways. I referenced this in my remarks when, in 1955, in 1958, 1960, there weren't very many conservative organizations. As an example, when we held our first conservative political action conference in the early 1970s, 100 people attended, and it was sponsored by 4 organizations. Not because we were exclusivists, but because there weren't any other ones. So at the time that the John Birch Society was sort of publicly running down the street acting like fools, there weren't any other organizations, so it was easy for the opponents of a developing conservatism to say, oh, you're them. Mm-hmm. Today, if somebody runs down the street acting like a fool, he's one of 300 organizations, and you don't have to worry about him, because you now have an identification that's much more accepted. So that's now if a Bircher comes, or somebody, we have people on both sides of the political spectrum who believe in all kinds of crazy theories, conspiracy theories and stuff. You don't have to drive them out of the building. You just have to say, you're wrong. In those days, in order to survive, because there wasn't any other way that they could be used to brand you, you had to say, you're wrong and please leave. that was my point. The objectivists was really in some ways a different. The legitimate case that Bill had, it reflected in part by the Whitaker Chambers, I think, which was assigned in the class, the Whitaker Chambers review of Atlas Shrugged, was the strict ideological nature of objectivism. But that was compounded in Bill's mind by the fact that he was a devout Catholic and Ayn Rand was an atheist. Now, there are those who would say that's what it's all about, and then there are those who would say, but objectivism without the ideology, without the constraints, is not a big problem, because we agree with a lot of those people, and they have not only moved into, one of Ayn Rand's most well-known disciples was Alan Greenspan, mm-hmm. who was an objectivist. So yes, they're in it, but it's a different world today than it was then. And when you're looking at the history of a movement, you have to ask yourself, what was it like at the time that they did that? And that's why he was trying to construct something, as I said, he was trying to open a bar that he could get other people to come into.
Next question. Mr. Salmaska?
Back to objectivism. On that subject and on Ayn Rand, Whitaker Chambers wrote, when a system of materialism presumes to give positive answers to the real problems of our real life, mischief starts. Mm-hmm. And I was sort of confused by that statement, because I look at materialism as, free enterprise and the pursuit of profit, which is, I think the arc of history shows, it's always improved the standard of living, increases life expectancy, decreases infant mortality rates.
That would be Hayek, because Rand would agree with everything that Hayek wrote, but then she would go further into this whole question of selfishness and the religious side. In fact, I have a friend who constantly argues with the people at the Cato Institute. Because their auditorium is the Hayek auditorium. In fact, Hayek also wrote that there needed to be these moral foundations, which Ayn Rand that's where she would part with him. But on the whole question of free enterprise, capitalism, and all of that, they would be in complete agreement. Remember that the first great free market economist was Adam Smith, who also wrote a book called The Theory of Moral Sentiments, which was, and he was a professor of theology. So so that side of it, whether the Randian or the non-religious libertarian would say, can you be, you know, a free market person? Can you have decent values? Can you do that without being religious? Well, what experience says is yes, you can. But most people don't. And the other one, so if you get into that argument where they say you have to leave because you don't go to church, then that's obviously wrong. But but what Rand was saying, you ought to leave because you do go to church. You know, that's just as wrong. So that's where that tension came about. And that sort of, it still exists to some degree, but not nearly to the degree to the fact that I forget what year she published Atlas Shrugged, but if picture yourself, you're in Manhattan, and you're in the cultural, literary, philosophical, political thing of Manhattan, and who would then at that stage be two giants? If you're thinking on the right, where there wasn't anybody, there would be William Buckley and Ayn Rand. And then think about how they would get along. And that explains a lot.
I think just to make the point more strongly, I think we assigned the first chapter of Goldwater's Conscience of a Conservative. I think he makes the case there for conservatism as being rooted in nature. He makes the case that it's not even an ideology, but it's actually rooted in nature. Next question. Yes, Cadet Faust.
It seems like the conservative movement at the time became a victim of its own success, pretty much. We received an influx, and like you said, we weren't able to educate them. How do we recover and get that core group back that's kind of been diluted and fringed? And the other is, because I hope that we become as successful and see that kind of shift back into the movement again. How do we keep from repeating that same mistake? How do we educate everybody in true conservative ideals and not just these fringe groups?
History would suggest that it's very difficult not to repeat that mistake, because that's the experience of successful movements of the right, left, or center. As the rats join the ship, and I always say the problem is that you need the rats to win, but if they're there long enough, they'll probably take over because they reproduce a lot. But in order to be successful over time, you have to do as much as you can and spend as much time as you can inculcating the values that created the ideas and values that create a movement into the next generation. I can relate a personal story because it was mentioned in the introduction that I was chairman of the Young Americans for Freedom, which, as I pointed out, was once described as the most important political youth organization of that decade. And Broder pointed that out, says, you know, historians write about SDS and all these groups, but they never took over anything, you know, and Young Americans for Freedom did. But Young Americans for Freedom became virtually a meaningless organization over time, and the roadmap that resulted in it becoming meaningless was a roadmap that I created inadvertently, because it got to its largest membership when I was the chairman, and it was a result of the Vietnam War. So what had happened was that we had a conservative organization where people were socialized, and then the Vietnam War broke out and violence took place on the campus, and our numbers began to swell because the fraternities and the football teams all joined us, you know, in reaction to a violent left. And in a period of a couple of years, our membership tripled. But once the left went away, they didn't know why they were there. You know what I mean? In other words, that they had come in as in reaction to something. And that's what happens in a political kind of context. You react to, remember, this is a country that is essentially non-ideological. It is a country that is not politically obsessed, but it reacts to things. So I'll give you a good example, more parochially. when a president, Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, is perceived as being anti-Second Amendment, the numbers of people flowing into the National Rifle Association's members shoots up incredibly. Now, when that stops, or when the challenge is overcome, a lot of them go away because they were there in reaction to something that was wrong. Now, in a political movement, it's a little different because they come in reaction. They come in, your numbers swell, and then they're there and they realize that I might get a job, and so when they get the jobs, or when they, rise in a political movement, if they didn't know why they were getting the job, then what value does it do from an ideas perspective to have them in the job? One of the important things about the Reagan administration, and Reagan was not a hands-on micromanager the way Jimmy Carter was when he. But the people that he tended to appoint knew what it was about. I mean, they knew what Reagan wanted. I worked in the Nixon administration. You could not get up in the morning knowing what the heck it was the president wanted. Because I don't know if he knew. I mean, he may have, but he didn't communicate it to anybody. So, so people went to work, and there were studies at the time of how many political appointees went bad. Bad in the sense that they weren't pursuing any kind of a unified, way of looking at things. If you worked for Ronald Reagan, you knew. I mean, you knew you might make mistakes, you might go bad, you might be captured by your agency or all the things that always happen in a bureaucracy, but you didn't have to get up in the morning and say, I wonder what the heck it is this president's all about. And what you want is a movement that is led and run, and we're down through it, they know. They know what it is that they're about. And that's why I say it's important that they know that rather than just I like X, because X might change his mind.
David, what holds together this political movement? This fusion movement. Is it the shared interest in holding power? Is that sufficient to hold it together?
No.
If not, what holds it together then?
An interest in holding there are different views of that. Bill Kristol has written that the only reason for a political movement is to hold and exercise power, and that anything that stands in the way of that, this is the argument for big government conservatives, anything that stands in the way of that needs to be jettisoned. And he's argued over the years that this idea of cutting government stands in the way of holding power because people like government, and mm-hmm. therefore you shouldn't be for cutting it. And the conservative argument is that's not why we're here. We're not here because we want to hold power. We're here because we want the power, A, restrained, and B, used in good rather than bad ways.
Yes, but the neocon so, will want to use it in one way. The libertarian
the,
will
well,
want
to... Well, the neocon wants to...
And the cultural conservatives
yeah, but
do differently.
They're all held together by the fact that if the other guys, not them, but the other guys, the big government liberals have it, they all lose.
Do they really lose? Does the neoconservative lose?
Yeah. Well, they do currently. Although they argued at the time when Buckley and others were questioning the adventurism of the foreign mm-hmm. policy, Kristol said, "Well, fine, we'll go back to the Democrats because we're more comfortable with them anyway," because their whole thing is essentially it's foreign policy based. The rest of it's veneer. And it's based on the theory, I think I related to you at the time the Soviet Union collapsed and before the Weekly Standard was founded, even before some of the other things, at an off-the-record dinner, Bill argued that America had to find another enemy because America had to go on a crusade because a nation is judged not by how it treats its people but how it performs on the world stage. And that therefore we needed an international crusade. And I said I thought that was evidence that he had never met any Americans. Because as we did not, our grandfathers didn't send our fathers to war to be part of a crusade. They sent them there because they thought it was necessary to protect our country, our way of life, and our friends. And when the war was over, they were perfectly happy to come back and run their tractors and and work in their gas stations and their factories, and they do not sit around wishing that their son could go off someplace, or their daughter in this case, go off someplace to be in harm's way. They hope that that won't happen. They're prepared to do it if they have to, but going to war is not a positive goal. You know, it's the last president we had that felt that way was Teddy Roosevelt, who thought it was, since it builds manly virtues, you had to look for a war if you couldn't find one. That's really not the American, you know, that the way of looking at things. But the neoconservatives actually sort of believe that. And that was before the, that's before the Muslim threat was a gleam in Osama bin Laden's eye.
Does 1989, the Berlin Wall falls. So does the Muslim threat now take the place? Is that,
well, they had to search
what,
for a while. The Muslim threat came a little later, you know.
But is that what's taking place now? Yes, exactly.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean that there isn't a threat. But is what's going on in the Middle East the existential threat that was posed by the Soviet Union? And if it is that the way that it's that you solve it?
Mm-hmm. Next question, gentlemen. Yes, Cadet Slater.
In the current Republican primary, there's really no clear consensus candidate right now. So, do you think that'll have an impact on how much these like fringe groups, that lunatic fringe like you talked about, will have in the general election? Do you think the media will focus on that and, more than normal? Do you think that they'll really play a bigger role?
No, I think what will happen is that the Republican, and if you recall, at this stage in 2008, there were all kinds of journalistic reports and pundits saying the Democrats won't be able to win because of the viciousness of the fight between Hillary and Barack Obama, the charges of racism and all the stuff that was going on. And as soon as the nomination was decided, all that ended and it was one team opposing the Republicans. The same thing will happen this time. The liberals would, the establishment press, they're sort of saying, well, maybe Ron Paul will, you know, run. Because that would hurt the Republicans. He's not going to do that. And the Republicans are not going to be stupid enough to completely shut him out. And the other candidates, I likened it because I know people that would like to do that. And I said, you know, the problem is that we have the single greatest unifying factor that we have ever had, and his name is Barack Obama. And I said, if you stood up at a group of conservatives and said, I don't really like the nominee, I think I'll run as an independent, the other ones would beat you to death because they'd say, wait a minute, you know, this is too important for that. This is not when we're going to play games. So I think that becomes a non-problem.
Next question. Mr. Ford.
Sir, you said that we have the one common threat, and that's Barack Obama. How come that hasn't caused a reactionary force like it was caused with Mr. Buckley and established a strong candidate for the conservative movement?
You mean one leader or one?
Right. Well, Buckley was a reactionary force to the New Deal and the progressive movement of the early 20th century. You say right now we on the right have a unifying opposition in Barack Obama. Why haven't we developed a reactionary movement to create one solid candidate as opposed to having these?
Well, a solid candidate is different from a solid movement. A candidate is the result, of various people with ambition who want to be the candidate. And Reagan did not become the candidate unopposed. That went on quite a while. When he challenged Ford, of course, he lost it at the last minute. So when you're talking about individuals vying to be leaders, that's a different thing. We also have, frankly, we have more conservative leaders, if you will, now than we've ever had. So all Barry Goldwater had to do, and I'm a Goldwater fanatic, but all he had to do is stand up in the Senate and say, I won't do this, you know, and nobody else stood up. And so they said, well, there's our leader. That's that. If he were there today and he stood up and said that, 18 other people would stand up and say, we're with you, Barry. And then there wouldn't be a leader. So I think that's a different kind of tension, different kind of process, if you will. And it'll end up ultimately with a nominee. You'll never get the movement and the Republicans will unite around their nominee. They will not unanimously agree over drinks that this guy was not better than that guy. You know, in other words, that shouldn't have been somebody else. That's a different question that goes to their evaluation of individuals.
Mr. Lacey?
There's conservative ideas, and then, as you mentioned, the conservative movement ended up sort of taking over the Republican Party and using the Republican Party as a vehicle to enact these ideas. Yet, because of the necessity of getting elected and such, there's still a lot of things that pass with Republican Congresses or Republican presidents that are not very conservative. Do you ever see things getting to a point where there isn't the need for these compromises, with something, for example, like farm subsidies, or the need where a conservative government can get rid of those instead of having to keep them around to remain in power?
Well, we did get rid of them once, and then they came back again. It is two things. One, power is seductive. And let me tell you a story. When I went to Washington, I was hired by Vice President Agnew. I had just graduated from law school at the University of Wisconsin. I put all of my stuff in a trailer and hooked it up to the back of my 10-year-old station wagon, and I drove to Washington. And I got a job with the Vice President of the United States in an office in what we then just called the Executive Office Building, and later became the old Executive Office Building, and now it's the Eisenhower Building, but it's the building next to the White House that used to be the War Department. It's a beautiful building. And so I got this office and I decorated it and hung my pictures and all that. This was 1970, and about a week or so later, the Vice President wandered into my office and he looked around and he said, Dave, you've done a great job. This is really nice. I said, well, thank you, sir. And he said, you know who had this office when Hubert Humphrey was Vice President? And I said, no, sir, I don't. He said, it's funny, neither does anyone else. And then he said, two things are going to happen to you in the next few weeks. He said, the first thing you're going to conclude is that this job that you have is really important. And then you're going to decide that there is one thing more important than the job itself, and that's the fact that you have it. And he said, I don't know how to tell you this, but neither one of those things is true. Well, and I've often thought that everyone that comes to Washington should have a boss who tells him that. Because somebody gets elected to Congress, and this was the end of the so-called revolution of 1994. In the summer of 1995, the new Speaker of the House, Mr. Gingrich, called his caucus together and said, the single most important thing that we need to do is be reelected. And so here are the cardinals of the Appropriations Committee. Anything you need, they will give you. Because all of a sudden, that job was important, and it was more important that they hold it. And as a result, all of the reasons that they had argued to the voters were essential to send them there went out the window. And that is the story of coming to Washington. And all too often it's the story. And you have all kinds of reactions to that. But the thing that always amazed me, and this happens time and again, in 1994, and it's happened since then, the candidates railed on about wasteful government spending, earmarks, all these various things. You have to send me there to fix it. Then they got there, and they decided within a matter of months the only way to get reelected was to involve themselves in wasteful spending, earmarks, and all of these different things. And I'd ask them, why is it that what worked once couldn't work again? Because you became what you opposed once you got there. And that's why you have the rise of things like the Tea Parties. That's why you have the rise of all these outside groups who say, wait a minute, we sent you there, you had a majority, and nothing happened. And nothing happened, not just because it's hard, And not just because there's an opposition to it, but because there's a good chance that you're going to become part of the problem if you're not careful. And that is not Gingrich said one accurate thing. That's not fair. He said many accurate things. But he said one accurate thing in 1993 and 94 as they were preparing for that election. And they were attacking the corruption and all of the abuses of power of 40 years of Democratic rule. Somebody asked him a reporter asked him if he thought that Democrats were somehow congenitally crooked. He said, no, it's just that they've been in power and they're human. And if our guys are in power long enough, they'll be just as bad. He was right about that, but the learning curve was quicker. It didn't take 40 years to figure out how to do these things. So occasionally you really have to get rid of them all, or get rid of a bunch of them, or bring in new people. That's one of the reasons that Bush lost. One of the reasons that we lost after Bush is that he, as Buckley said, was conservative but not a conservative. He did not understand all of it, and he didn't until the last minute when there was a big revolt. Didn't understand that part of what conservatism was about was the size of the government. His people famously would say to you, don't ask us about how much we're spending, ask us about how we're spending it. In other words, that would be your farm program. You know, we're not giving it, you know, to build public housing in Brooklyn, we're giving it to farmers in Iowa. You know, so those are our voters. Isn't that good? No, that's not good. If you were a conservative, you'd understand that's not good, but it's easy to be seduced by that as a way to get votes. I mean, you see it with Barack Obama now. And after all, when he ran, he was running on some of these same things. And so now every one of his programs is sort of targeted at some voter group that he's trying to get. They're not designed to solve the economic problem or anything of the like. They're designed to buy votes. Republicans do that. Democrats do that. They do it not because they're Republicans and Democrats, but because they're human. And it's one of the reasons that the founders didn't trust human beings, and that's what the Constitution's about.
Who are the good guys that understand conservatism today?
Well,
and the list won't be all inclusive, but who are some of the major ones?
I mean,
in our Senate and House.
Well, there are an awful lot of good people in the Senate and the House.
Let me take the word good out. Who are the people who understand conservatism, as you just mentioned? Truly understand it, or are
representative of conservatism?
Truly understand it.
I think in the House, he's now running for governor, that Mike Pence had an understanding of all, mm-hmm. had it all together. A very good example of that. We have some who are very good economic conservatives, some who are very good values conservatives, and some national defense people. It's hard to put that together in one person. It always has been. Reagan was unique in that way. Some of the others are not.
Cadet Salmaska?
Sir, speaking as Obama as a unifying force, it seems that back in 2004, with the Democratic infighting going on, John Kerry eventually becoming the nominee, maybe he's more electable than Howard Dean. It seemed that the overall prevailing message was anybody but Bush. Can that really work this time on the other foot?
It almost worked that time for the Democrats. And of course it did work in 2008. One of the problems that all presidents have is, and this was really the formula for Obama's problems, is that the reason a presidential candidate is elected is often very complicated and has less to do with people loving him and what he wants to do than he thinks. And this is always the case. In 2008, when Obama was elected, it was anybody but Bush. You'll remember all that. And that was partly true because Bush had an unpopular war. He had lost the sort of resonance with the public that he'd had right after 9/11. He seemed aloof. Then he had the economic problems. The Republicans had been in for a long time. And one of the reasons we have simple partisanships is that one party will say, you know, things are really terrible, and if you elect us, we'll create utopia. So they eventually happens, and then 8 years later or 16 years later, people say, you know, we don't have utopia, we've got all these problems, and then the other party will come along and say, yeah, but if you elect us, we'll do it. So that's part of that's natural. And candidates on the day before election realize all those things. Remember, Barack Obama ran as sort of a centrist with not much of a message other than hope and change and get rid of these people and change it all. And then that works right until the votes are counted. And then whoever you are, when you wake up the next morning, you are convinced that they elected you because you are wonderful. And they really want you to do everything that you really wanted to do, even if you didn't talk about it. You remember famously Bill Clinton and his wife decided to reform the healthcare system in the 90s because they had a mandate, and then somebody went and looked and found out there had been one sentence about healthcare in one speech that was never carried. You know, so he had woken up and decided, you know, I know what this election was about. It was about healthcare. Obama did the same thing this time because it was, but he began to think that he really was what his aides told him he was, which is he could do anything and the public really wanted it, and then discovered that isn't really the change they wanted. The change they wanted was to fire the people that were there and get new people. So when the next one comes around, part of it is anybody but. But in this case, Obama represents more than simply a president that some people are tired of, or a president that is not up to the job, as a lot of people feel. But he's a president with a very different vision of the future than the Republicans have, or I think than the majority of the American people have. So when you say anybody but Obama, it isn't anybody. That's a pre-nomination slogan. When you get to the actual general election, it's this guy who believes in this sort of vision of the future and that guy who believes in a different one. And in the case of Bush and Kerry, it came that way too, but people said, this guy is not up to this job and he doesn't want to take us where we want to go. And so they reelected Bush, but it's a closely divided country. So if your message is, I am just not him, that's enough to get you to 48%. And then you better have something to get you that other 3%. And it's not enough to just say, I don't like him. You've got to have your own things as well.
Questions?
I'm gonna ask one before we get back to the cadets, and that is, what do you think the key takeaway should be from Buckley that applies to today? The libertarians are not exactly considered as conservatives by many.
They are by me.
By many.
Buckley considered himself a libertarian. Ronald Reagan considered himself a libertarian.
Does a lot of our political leaders today don't consider Ron Paul a conservative?
That doesn't mean a libertarian isn't. You know, I mean.
Okay.
And they disagree. I actually think, and we always have this. I mean, this was after the last election, mm-hmm. when Ron Paul was also a candidate. Mm-hmm. You've got people in the party establishment, they may be conservatives, denigrating him. And one fellow whose name I won't use was at a meeting and he said, you know, I went to this county party meeting and it was really frightening because there were 300 people there and 200 of them were mm-hmm. Ron Paul people. Mm-hmm. And we've got to keep them out. I said, wait a minute, the job of a party leader is not to keep people out, it's to bring people in. The reality is, though, that a party is like a club. And every time there has been a wave of new people come into a party, there is an attempt to keep them mm-hmm. out. When Pat Robertson ran and brought in the evangelicals into the Republican Party, the national committeeman from Michigan, this was an earlier day, famously said that going to a Robertson affair was like the bar scene in Star Wars. that these were all weird people. Many of those people socialized into the party and are now party leaders. When Goldwater came along, similar things were said about his people. These shopkeepers and people that, you know, are being allowed into the party. These Southerners. I was asked when I was in the White House in 1972, we ran a campaign in the Nixon administration called Operation Switch, which mm-hmm. was designed to get Democratic office holders to switch parties, primarily in the South. And I remember a Republican congressman coming to me and screaming at the top of his lungs that this was a terrible, terrible idea. We don't want those people in our party because, one, they're tacky. And secondly, he said, and he finally let it out, he said, if they come in, they're going to be running against us in primaries. 8 years later, he got beaten in a primary by a former Democrat. But the fact is that we might like their votes, but we don't want them in the meetings. And that's true no matter what the group is. And now it's the Ron Paul people. These people are weird. These people are strange. And my position to him was, yeah, and Ron Paul has gotten almost 50% of the 30 and under vote in every single primary he's run in. And if you want to kick that away, feel free. But a party builder's job is not to kick people out, it's to bring people in. So yes, you're going to get that. Yes, you're going to hear it. And are they going to come in and not mature? Did the Robertson people come in and, you know, force everybody to go to church or whatever it was they were going to do? You know, I mean, it doesn't work that way. What happens is that they come in, they bring energy. Those who were, if Ron Paul is gone, a third of them go home, a third of them stay. You know, I mean, that's the way it works. And if you're going to build a movement, what you try to do is you've got people who agree with you on lots of things, and you try to get them to agree with you on the other things and make them part of the family. And that's what the party has to do with these people.
Well, I see that our time is up. David, you're one of the chief spokesmen for conservative principles in politics, and you've been central to the Buckley legacy.
I've been around.
We thank you so much for being here today, and hope you'll come back often.
Thank you.
Next week on Lectures in History, City College of New York history professor Judith Stein discusses the United States in the 1970s. Join us each Saturday at 8 p.m. and midnight Eastern, and Sundays at 1 p.m. for classroom lectures from across the country on different topics and eras of American history. Lectures in History are also available as podcasts. Visit our website at cspan.org/history/podcasts or download them from iTunes.